see what kind of questions have arisen today. It says, as I meditate, I concentrate on the breathing. However, the breathing seems to disappear. My mind starts to wander. What should I do? Well, of course, especially if you're concentrating, closely on the breathing, and if you're gaining some success in that, and if you're getting concentrated, and the mind and body is getting very tranquil, the more you concentrate, the breath will get lighter and lighter. And sometimes it may feel like it disappeared. So actually, that's good. But at that point, you don't want the mind to wander. So if the breath has disappeared, you could just be aware of the awareness that's left. Because if you've already reached that stage and the mind has become tranquilized and the breath seemed to disappear, then often what is left is just awareness. And you can just be aware of that awareness. But if there's thoughts arising and you need some object, then concentrate on the contact points of the body itself, such as where the buttocks press the floor, or where your hands touch, or you pick one, or it could even be more, or do a body scan. You can use the body itself for the object of concentration at that time, and then go into vipassana, or just to then be mindful. If the thoughts come, be mindful of the thoughts. But if you need that contact of the something concentration object, then select one or more type of contact points, such as I just mentioned. Hands touching the feet, touching the floor, the buttocks, anything that can help you to hold your attention, and you use that as a substitute for the breath, and you carry on your mindfulness with that. Or you could do a body scan, or just go into the moment-to-moment type of vipassana. So those are the alternatives. That's the natural progression of meditation anyway. Especially if you're, the breath is used actually to get into the body. And if you follow the progress of Satipatthana Sutta, breath is only the first part. It gets you to the body. And once your mind is in the body, you become aware of the postures. And then the sensations, four elements. And then that takes you into the Vedana, the experience, the contemplation of feelings, mind states, and basically the Vipassana awareness, until it leads to the perception of impermanence, and then the transcendence of self-identity, where the sense of self and ego dissolves. You don't need more than that. That's it. In a nutshell. Anyway, I'll talk about more of that tomorrow, actually, the anatta and the deeper levels of impermanence and anatta. Given the possible effects of negative karma from this and previous lives that may be expressed at the time of death, there are grounds for fear. Oh? And why is that, I might ask? So, how therefore to be relaxed at the point of death? As I mentioned before, You die the way that you live. And so if your mind is full of anxiety, worry, and fear, then you're going to pretty much die that way. Unless you have a super level of concentration and so on, that you can sort of suppress all those things, all those emotions. So how to be relaxed at the point of death is how to be relaxed in your daily life. You know, before you die, that's the whole point. This is a preparation for death, not wait to the last minute. You know, a preparation now, you start now. And the younger you start, the better. Because then the less clutter and the less rubbish you have to deal with. Or at least the longer time that you have to then try to purify whatever types of negative states you have, and you know, collect more merit and so on, that can help to offset some of that negative karma, and so that you can feel good about yourself and relaxed. So, but you can't expect to just live your life and then just in the last short period expect to somehow you know, turn all those things off. So that's why the whole point of this meditation is to you know, prepare oneself to deal with the unfinished business. And we'll talk more about that later. And of course, stop doing fresh things that agitate the mind. Such as that's the whole purpose of following precepts. Because the reason why people have fear and anxiety in their mind, because they have, you know, done things they shouldn't have done, according to precepts, Dhamma, and haven't done the things that should have been done, like cultivate more meditation and other wholesome practices. So, you know, that's, you know, that's the practice of Dhamma. But, you know, you can't sort of erase the karma that you've already created. You can't kind of erase it. And there's certain types of karma, as I mentioned, that, you know, may have to be experienced. And there's other types of karma that may go defunct. Or if you increase the amount of merit, the more meditation, wisdom, and other wholesome qualities you cultivate, that might, at least at the time of death, those memories of the wholesome things might come up as this death-proximate karma or habitual karma that I mentioned, and override, you know, some of these other negative things. But if you don't have anything in the box, so to speak, you know, if you don't have any wholesome qualities readily available, then you may be in for a rough ride, or at least more anxiety. And so it doesn't really feel do good to feel guilty about things that you've done, especially long ago. I mean, if you do an unskillful action, you should there and then make a kind of a vow not to repeat it, and use all the tools of the Dhamma to help you not to keep repeating it. As I mentioned this today in this little stanza, you know, you sow a thought, reap an action. Sow an action, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a destiny or a character. And so the character reach the destiny. So, you know, if you do a couple of unwholesome things, But you stop, you know, before it becomes like a habit. You know, you might get away with not suffering too much for those unwholesome things. But if you allow it to become a habit, and at some point you're going to be more unmindful, and then you're going to get caught big time and suffer more. Whatever the habits were, telling lies, stealing, you know, kind of breaking any of the kind of precepts and so on. And then the consequences, you know, would be more. So, but feeling the shame and scruples, these are what are called the guardians of the mind, are two mental factors called hiri and otappa. That means a sense of shame at doing wrong things. Some people have no shame. They're just shameless. They just do anything. But knowing what you know, what is right or wrong according to Dhamma, and if you do it, but it's not seen as a negative thing. It just means it will make you not want to do it again. And sort of a sense of shame and conscientious, being conscientious about what you're doing. In terms of course, the Dhamma. So that it basically just helps you to be more mindful, that's all. You know, and when you're about to use some bad speech, you're about to do some other unwholesome types of things, you know, that's when you need your mindfulness, and then to apply the right effort to abandon that thought or intention and cultivate the opposite. So that's the importance of the right thought. Hopefully we'll have time to kind of discuss that a bit later. But oh, here's a similar. Can we change or influence the karma? If I do something unwholesome, can I consciously balance it out by doing something unwholesome? Okay, again, if you do something unwholesome, it doesn't mean by doing wholesome things you're going to necessarily erase that, but as I just got through mentioning, you can perhaps minimize the effects, or the good effects of the wholesome actions might delay or negate or delay the effects of the unwholesome one. But again, the more merit that you accumulate, that means cultivating wholesome things, practicing kindness, generosity, observing precepts, meditating, studying, gaining wisdom, associating with good friends, you know, little by little giving up your bad habits, and keep you, you know, enslaved to sense certain, you know, some sensual pleasures and so on, practicing metta to overcome one's anger, sympathetic joy to overcome one's jealousy, and so on, practicing forgiveness. All these things are, you know, considered to be the wholesome types of training, which would help to weaken the painful effects, or perhaps in some cases, minimize the result of some of the painful things one did. But again, the more habitual those things become, then the more chance that those habitual good qualities will come to the mind at the time of death and override, at least temporarily, whatever negative memories are there. You mentioned some heavy karma that, like strong bulls, break through the gate. Are there any good strong bulls, heavy karma, that will follow you through next life? Yes, what are they? Meditate. Follow the Noble Eightfold Path. Step by step, don't leave any out. That is your best guarantee. And if you happen to attain the stream winning, that's even better. Before you die, to attain the stream, basically, when you attain the first stage of enlightenment, the stream entry, it's like you burn off 75% of your old karma, so to speak. Because if you don't attain stream entry, your mind could go on for another 1,000,000 or 2,000,000,000 lifetimes of rebirth. But just by the attainment of stream entry, it is said that that wipes out enough karma that you'd only have 7 more lifetimes at the most before one would attain full liberation. You know, so that's quite a step, from 1,000,000 or more lifetimes down to 7 only, in one fell stroke of insight. It wipes out that much kind of karma. And if you attain the second stage, then it wipes out even, you know, 99%. You only have 1 more lifetime to come back. So that's the power of Dhamma. And that's the only guarantee, is attaining the paths and fruits. That's the only sort of a guarantee that of wiping out the past karma. But again, that heavy karma, I'll just tell you one little story. Some of you might have heard it. It's a story of Arhant Moggallana. Okay, he was an arhant. He already attained full liberation, right? And he had psychic power. He said with one toe he could rock the Sakya's palace up in the Tusita heaven. You know, that much mighty power. But in a previous lifetime, even like many lifetimes in the past, he had killed his parents. And he still hadn't kind of paid for that, I guess. And so, just before he was to die, he was in his cave. And 3 robbers came to the cave who were going to kill him. Because with his clairvoyant power, he could see them coming. And so he made himself invisible. That's his psychic power. So the robbers came in, and the robbers were following him. So they saw him go into the cave. They said, "Oh, we'll get him." So they went into the cave. He made himself invisible, and where is he? Couldn't find him. So they left. The next day they came back again, and again Moggallana made himself invisible. The robbers, you know, couldn't find him and left again, because they saw him enter each time. And the third time, Moggallana saw them coming again. And then he thought, you know, these guys really want me, you know. I must have done something bad. So he used his powers of the mind and realized that he had killed his parents. In a past life, he'd never paid for it. And then he said, that's why. I have to experience the result of that karma before I can die. And so, third time, he didn't make himself invisible. The robbers came in and said to crush every bone in his skeleton. And, you know, they thought he was dead. But with his psychic power, he could reassemble his bones enough to walk to where the Buddha was living, to pay his last respects to the Buddha, because that was a tradition that the disciples, before they died, it was a tradition that they go and pay their respects to the Buddha or to their teacher. And so, you know, with his psychic power, he was able to do that, pay his respect to the Buddha, and then he dropped dead. He said, "My job's over." So anyway, I'm just telling that story. You may not believe it, but you know, it's a very popular story in the Buddhist text. But it shows that, you know, like that heavy karma, you know, he had to sort of pay for that. And even though he was fully enlightened. But it's, he didn't. And then there's other stories. I'm not going to go into all of them, though. Angulimala and all that. If you read the Buddhist text, you'll be able to read so many wonderful kind of stories like that that illustrate different aspects of the Dhamma. What determines the body the spirit is reborn in? Oh, what determines the kind of body that the mind, I guess the mind, we don't call it spirit, we call it the mind, rebirth consciousness, in the Buddhist terminology. Is it random or determined? Again, it's largely determined by the karma. If you have the karma to be born as a woman, you'll get a woman's body. If you have the karma to be born as a man, you'll get a man's body. And if you have a good karma, you might be born in a very good family, influential family, and you know, where you have everything you need and this and that. But if you have the karma to suffer, you might be born in a family of alcoholics or, you know, where you divorce or experience all kinds of, you know, sufferings and so on. So these kind of things are said to be the result of the karmas. And, you know, some New Age people or even the Tibetans say that, the mind kind of goes around the world selecting its own family to be born. But in the Theravada tradition, they don't believe you're kind of going around selecting where you'd be born. But it's like a magnetic pull according to the karmic vibration. You see, when you die, the mind has a certain kind of magnetized vibration, which could be like, you know, again, this the last signs before you die, the strongest memories, then it will take that vibration and find the appropriate place, like a magnetic pull. And I like to give the analogy of a cell phone. It's kind of contemporary analogy about the rebirth. Okay, so you have a cell phone, you want to call somebody over in India, halfway around the world. So you punch in, 10 numbers. And, you know, within a couple seconds, some invisible energy goes out of your cell phone. They don't even have antennas now. You know, in the old days, at least there was an antenna, right? And the energy went out the antenna, and now they don't even have that. So somehow, you're in a concrete room, numbers, and somehow that energy out of 50 million cell phones in India, it finds the exact one. Right? I'm like, wow. To me, that's more difficult to understand than rebirth. But anyway, so it's like, and there's an area code. Right, so you have to dial area code means the plane you'll be reborn in. Human realm, animal realm, deva realm, hell, preta. That's sort of like the area code. No, it's true. Because there's a certain vibration that gets you born in these places. So, you know, depending on what kind of memories and habits and are there in the consciousness. And then the number is your individual number. So the area code gets you to a certain plane, but your individual number or vibration finds the appropriate family or place, situation, where you'll be arise to carry out or finish your unfinished business. or to experience the result of the kamma. And the kamma actually, you know, a lot of people think kamma is like punishment. But actually kamma is an evolutionary tool. You know, if we keep on suffering, we keep on doing things over and over, and we keep on suffering, at some point we'll kind of wake up and be aware, I'm suffering because of this. And it helps you to change, because no one wants to suffer. And so if we keep on making the same mistakes over and over and suffering on it, then it will help us try to move on from that, to help you change. So actually it's good. Even if it's painful. And if the results are very painful. We learn from pain. If you're too comfortable, you get lazy. You know, people, evolution happens through pain. Not totally, but anyway, it's, you know, the challenges are in pain. It forces you to deal with the situation. Like the pain in your body. So when you're meditating, you have the pain there. Either you go mad or you deal with it. Either you get up and run away crying, Mama, Mama. Or you deal with it. So it forces you to deal with the situation. Or your own grief. You know, your own fear of death. It forces you to deal with it. And that's good. Because otherwise people don't deal with it. Since people are born because of ignorance and birth is the cause of death, what is the purpose of life? To overcome ignorance and reach the deathless state. From the Dharma point of view, that's the purpose of life. Is to wake up from the illusion of ignorance and the web of suffering, and basically to transcend it by attaining the stages of enlightenment. From the Buddhist point of view, that is really the only true purpose in life, or at least noble purpose. Of course, the purpose to, like the Bodhisattva, to help others, that's also a noble purpose, but to do that, you're also, treading the path of Dhamma. Anyway, I might, if I have time, I'll try to touch on some of those things in the last couple of days of the retreat. If we have no soul, what happens when we die? So people think they have to have a soul to die. I just mentioned that electricity that goes out of the cell phone is not a soul, it's just energy. It doesn't need a soul. To call your friend in India, does that energy have a soul? No, it just goes there because of magnetic attraction. But then, of course, when you get in the next life because of ignorance, then, especially in terms of a human being, then the sense of ego and I consciousness will again develop in the next life. But in Buddhist, in the Dhamma teachings, the idea of some kind of unchanging, permanent little soul, however you imagine it, as a little atom or something inside of you that is yours forever, that is not believed in the Buddhist tradition. Where the Buddha saw that actually that's an illusion. Because people who believe in that haven't actually seen that it's an illusion, and they, you know, so they believe that it's something permanent and unchanging, because they didn't have the depth of wisdom to see that actually it's not something static, but it's a continual changing, ever-changing process. But the continuity is there, but still that's not the soul. You can say, I mean, it's sort of the personality. But, you know, if you use that term, you have to sort of understand the meaning of it. You know, there is the ego, but it's not something that's static. You know, it's always changing. And you're not even the same person really as you were when you were a child, are you? You can say you're totally different, but yet there's some kind of continuity there. Isn't it? From when you were, you know, 5 years old? Are you the same person? So the same way, when the mind goes to a new life, it's not the same person's mind, but there's a continuity because it's constantly undergoing changes. You're not even the same person, you know, from day to day, because everything you come in contact with, every experience changes you in some way or another. So in that sense, nothing is remaining the same. Anyway, come back to this question. What happens when we die? Okay, the mind goes on. I've heard mention about being born again or even coming back as a hungry ghost. What determines... I think I've already covered that in today's talk about what determines the karma and what kind of planes of existence are available for various types of karmic actions. You know, it's really a very deep subject, and it's not easy to, you know, describe it in any, you know, exact precise detail. Although some people try to, but anyway, I cannot. But according to the Buddhist texts, all these things are there. But it's also been corroborated through, because all religions believe in some type of, you know, even Christianity is a type of rebirth, because when you die, the soul goes to heaven. That's a rebirth. Call it by any other name, it's a rebirth. But they think it's permanent because they don't have the wisdom to see that, you know, they'll fall out of that heaven world at some point and go on again. But anyway, I don't want to get into, you know, religious dogmas and so on. To me, the impermanence of thoughts and sensations, as well as the benefits of mindfulness, can be directly observed in meditation and life. However, reincarnation and nibbana cannot. Well, it maybe cannot for you and for many people, but it has been certainly for many others. To me, this requires a type of faith, like in many other religions. Do you experience doubt? Are there Buddhist teachings that discuss doubt, as in many other religions? Ah, very good question, yes. Doubt is one of the fetters, and it's also a hindrance for meditation. You know, when you're meditating and you have these doubts, time I meditated, what's going to happen? I don't know. Is the Buddha, what's this guy Buddha? You know, was he enlightened or what? You know, what's this Dhamma? What are these monks? You know, I don't know. Doubt. So that prevents you from giving your all to the meditation. It holds back. Doubt holds you back from giving your all to the practice. But I mentioned that state of entering the stream. Do you remember that? I just mentioned it. The first stage of enlightenment. Well, the hallmark of entering the stream is permanently overcoming all doubts, especially about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, or the reality of enlightenment, things like that. It totally destroys them. And the reason is, because in that experience of entering the stream, which is called a path knowledge, or the first sort of glimpse of Nibbana, the deathless state, you fully experience the total transcendence of, you know, eye consciousness and any trace of separation and ego, ego identity. And you experience just a radical new type of dimension of the deathless state, the unconditioned state. But only for a moment, usually. But in that moment, it's so crystal clear that all the belief in any permanent soul is totally abolished. Because you see that there isn't one. And doubts about it are totally abolished. The doubts are abolished because you've seen that the ego is an illusion. So that's the way you eliminate doubts. And that's the hallmark of a Sotapanna. They wouldn't have any doubts about the teaching. Now that doesn't mean you have experience of rebirth and reincarnation necessarily. But that's not really the doubts preventing somebody from being a Sotapanna, not having direct experience about rebirth. But it's about faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So the faith would be fully cemented. But that faith is from direct experience, not just belief. There's three levels of faith. You need faith. Without faith, you're not going to do anything. You know, if you don't believe that something is going to work, you're not going to give any effort to do anything or to change. When people have faith, if they follow a diet, they can lose 50 pounds. You know, they see it advertised, right? So they, you know, want to try it. Now, of course, it may or may not work. They have faith in a certain medicine or a drug, or faith in a certain doctor. So faith is necessary for anything in life. And so the same way when you're talking about what's beyond death, or when you hear the Dhamma, like for me, I didn't know much about the Dhamma. When I went to that meditation course in Nepal and, you know, heard the Dhamma, it was like, you know, wow, I never heard this before. It was like, wow, you know, something can be done about suffering. You know, I can change the mind. And here are the tools to do it. So you get faith to practice. And as you practice, you get the results. Maybe not Nibbana immediately, of course, but, you know, you get results. You realize, oh, this practice of meditation, I can, you know, release a little bit of stress. You know, I can control my anger a little bit better. I can, you know, get some moments of some inner peace. So every time you get some of these kind of moments and insights, it increases your faith to want to practice more. So that is the way that one develops faith. It's not blind faith, it's faith because you're making progress. You can see it for yourself. You're not stupid. And so you know when the mind is making progress. Because your suffering that you've been experiencing for so long is finally, there's finally some light in it. Even though it's very little by little by little. But nevertheless, that's, you know, something. So, anyway, so the faith, there's three levels of faith. First level of faith is the, what do you call it, exciting faith. You hear something new, and that gives you the energy to start practicing. As you start practicing meditation, and you see, you know, a lot of people when they hear about Buddhist teaching, oh, nirvana, enlightenment, oh yeah, 6 months, right? Sotapanna, wow, 6 months. Two retreats. And after two retreats, three retreats. And after three retreats, four retreats. And after 200 retreats, 300 retreats. And so the next level of faith is the long enduring faith. That means the excitement has worn off, but still you're getting enough little experiences here and there to know that still something is happening, even though it's slower than you expected. And so you tough it out. You have the faith to kind of tough it out through thick and thin, or through ups and downs, or, and so on. And then, eventually at some point, when you do have the spiritual faculties matured enough, and you attain the stream entry, then that faith becomes unshakable faith. It's called unshakable faith. That couldn't be shaken by anything. No Jehovah's Witness could talk you out of faith in the Buddha. Okay? So other religions have blind faith in them. They tell you, say, don't ask questions, just believe, just do this, follow all these people. You still might get some, you know, some type of experience or happiness through doing that. But in the Buddhist teaching, sure, in the beginning, you have to kind of, maybe it's a little bit blank. But you're actually, you know, experiencing some results little by little, so that kind of keeps you going. Because unless you test anything, you're not going to know anything. You have to give something a test to find out if it's going to have any benefit. But so many people, they have very little patience. And Westerners, they want everything instant. So they might try one technique for one or two times and no instant enlightenment. Ah, this don't work. And then go practice something else. And they, you know, then they practice something else, and they keep on just jumping around, hoping for some instant enlightenment, for some quick results. But when we practice the Dhamma, we're in it for the long haul, not a quick fix. Although for many people, very quickly you can get some kind of some positive experiences, even with a short time of meditating, especially in terms of a little bit less stress and so on. But you know, that's important for the average person. Can meditation break the karmic cycle? Can it erase past karma? If so, how? Well, I think I've already answered that question. But yes, meditation can break your habits. So by cultivating mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, by following sila, by following right effort, by following the Noble Eightfold Path, that is the method that you can change your habits, because it lies in intention. You know, intention, that urge to do something, that is where karma, you know, starts. It starts as an intention. Oh, I think I'll tell a lie. So you have to have your mindfulness at that moment of intention in order to see it, and then apply your wisdom to know that that's an unwholesome intention. It's only going to bring suffering. And applying the right effort to drive it out of your mind and to create the opposite effect. So instead of stealing something, give charity, practice charity. Instead of telling a lie, tell the truth. Instead of telling somebody's faults, tell their good qualities. Instead of letting a cockroach drown in a puddle of water, pick it up and save its life. So these are the way that we, actively and directly change the karmic cycle of our thoughts and actions. But without mindfulness and a certain amount of wisdom, then it will be very difficult. Because it's being able to notice your urges and intentions when they're first arising is where you have to have your mindfulness and wisdom on that, so that doesn't develop into the karmic action. Seems to be a lot of questions today. Many people, for various reasons of suffering, want death. In the province of Quebec, Canada, assisted suicide is now legal. Is assisted suicide an appropriate or inappropriate way to die? Well, again, that's another hot button topic, I think. These days, but instead of assisted suicide in course of, like, let's say, terminal illness, but regular suicide, where a person chooses suicide because they're suffering in their mind and they're in a black hole and they just want to end it, that is a little bit different than, you know, being sort of in a terminal illness where your death is sort of imminent anyway, probably fairly shortly, there's your person's in a vegetative state, and somebody helps them to die. I mean, I would say there would be a difference in the kind of result, karmic result of the mind, in how it's going to be affected by, let's say, the rebirth process. You know, according to the first precept in the Buddhism, especially for, let's say, a monk, even suggesting for somebody to take their own life is a serious offense for a monk. So a monk should never even suggest that to anybody, because it's actually a very serious monastic offense. But if somebody else is going to do it on their own, just don't ask a monk. Just do it without asking a monk. But anyway, again, in terms of, is that an appropriate way to die? You know, I would say maybe in certain circumstances, it may be. But, you know, again, that's just a personal thing, and I'm not going to advocate anybody to do it. But in my case, she's my mother. She's 95 years old. And for many years, even, she said that, you know, if I ever get in a position where I'm on life support and this and that, to, you know, pull the plug. And she's a very intelligent woman and so on. And I would respect her opinion. But I told my brother and sister, when that happens, don't ask me. I won't go to Sri Lanka. You know, do what you have to do. I'm not giving any comment whether to do it or not do it. You know, if somebody is of sound mind, and again, the karmic consequences, it's hard to know what the karmic consequences would be. You know, and it's debatable. People will be debating that in the Dharma halls for the next 100 years. But, you know, each person has to... It's the motive of why you want to end the life. You know, it could be compassion for your relatives. If you're being in a hospital and life support is draining all their finances and everything else, and it's just a matter of some days or months, and you're, you know, in a vegetative state or something like that. Or if you give your consent, then again, but each family has to make their own choices on that. And there's subtle, you know, there's the motives of people can be very subtle, so it's also kind of tricky. So ideally, it would be best not to be in that situation. And if somebody asks you to assist, I wouldn't do it. Just so that you wouldn't have any... Now, I know there's one person here who works in a vet, for a vet, and they have to euthanize animals, and the kind of question came up about that. So, you know, there's all kind of tricky situations. I mean, as a person who practices Dhamma, you're going to find yourself challenged in many situations to be able to keep the precepts fully, because in this world there's just, you know, so many things are going to challenge us, you know, to try to adhere, you know, faithfully to, you know, the precepts and so on. And there's always going to be situations where you have to decide to do something or not do something. The same way with protecting your life against an intruder, you know. You know, have to shoot some person who threatens to kill you or your family. So, you know, these are, you know, dilemmas that people have to go through. But again, always remember that karma is the intention. And the result of the karma usually is in direct proportion to the strength of the intention. The intention being greed, hatred, and delusion. So if the greed, hatred, and delusion is stronger, then the result would be stronger. But if it's very, very weak, in case of just trying to, you know, defend oneself, and like, then, you know, there still may be some result, but it probably wouldn't be as strong. And each person has to accept the responsibility for what they do. And there's no guarantees of what is going to be the karmic result, really. Our depression and exaggerated fear, karmic attributes. Let's say more about karma, national karma, family karma. How do we work with these? That's a big question. So. But, you know, whatever states come up in you, whether it's depression, fear, worry, these are the result of previous karmas that you've done that are arising because of whatever situation. These arise. So it's the result of the past karma, but depending on if you commit more karma on account of what arises because of that fear, if you then, you know, shoot somebody or something, now that becomes active karma. That means you've just created more karma. But the fear that arises is not creating karma. That's the result already of past karma that arises, or anger. It only creates more karma when you act upon it. And then it produces another result. And then it keeps on going like that. The result triggers another cause. And then that cause triggers another result. And that result triggers another cause, unless you break it through the practice of mindfulness. Anyway, this topics of like collective karma, national karma, I mean, these are, again, you know, these are difficult things to know all the, but you could say there's kind of some truth in sort of collective karma. Now, if you had the karma to be born as an American, and you travel to Muslim countries now, and just because you're an American, you become a target. Okay, that's a kind of collective karma. Because you're an American, not your own personal karma, but you had karma to be born in a certain country. And because of the sort of collective karma of that country or the actions of that country, you get identified with it, you might get targeted. So in a sense, you know, you could say that's sort of a kind of collective karma or any other type of race or ethnic group. It may not be your own personal things that you did, but you did something to, you know, get into that group. Let's say somebody had it against Buddhists and they came out here with a machine gun and mowed us all down. But because you had that interest in Buddhism and you came to a Buddhist temple, so in that sense, you, because of that collective karma, you were got involved. So I think that's at least one way you might see this idea about the collective karma. But of course, there could be much more individual karma involved in that too. But again, it's so complicated, we're not going to ever really probably know that. And with family karma, yes, families have the strongest karmic ties. And your mother and father, brother and sister may very well have been your relatives in past lives. You had unfinished business to work out. Especially families that argue and quarrel and get broken up and where there's lots of suffering. Or even people who, like people love at first sight and people get married and they lived happily their whole life. They probably had been associated in past life with good experiences, and because of that, they were reborn again and came back together again. There's plenty of examples of these in the Buddhist texts, too. And along with this idea of the rebirth, you know, in all those rounds of samsara I was talking about, that you said that, you know, we've been everybody's mother, brother, aunt and uncle, brother and sister, grandparents of everybody in the, you know, world, basically. You know, all those infinite number of lifetimes. And so everybody, in that sense, we're all karmically related. And that's the foundation of doing metta. So the same kindness that you would look about your own child, anybody else you see, well, they might have been my child in the last life. They might have been my mother in the last life. So you treat them with the same sort of kindness that you would treat your own child or mother in this life. That's the kind of the basis of the practice of metta. If I have to give everything back, what's left? Very concerned. Me, myself, and I. It's not really that you give everything back. In a sense you could say that, but basically you have to exhaust whatever, karmic energies have been accumulated. And what's left? Well, the answer to that is, just you could say emptiness or the deathless state. And so, it's not defined as what's left, it's what's absent. So nirvana is called the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. What more do you want? It's defined as the end of suffering. What more do you want? This is P.S. Did you tell anybody that I was choking on the grape? Did you let anybody know that I was choking on the grape? Somebody might have helped. No, I didn't want to be embarrassed that I was teaching mindfulness, right? So I tried to hide it, So somehow I managed to try to maintain equanimity as I kind of quickly got up from my seat and walked around the corner. And fortunately, I was able to get it out fairly quickly by my own means. I came back like nothing ever happened. Bhante Dhamma remembered that. He would have come over to help me, I'm sure. He would have hit me on the back. No, never. Don't say that. The power outage just discombobulated all the clocks. Anyway, I don't know, time is getting away. This one question I might answer later on about daily practice, about doing on the last days. I think I'll keep these for tomorrow. Don't ask so many questions tomorrow. Okay.